Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 700. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about Spanish explorers, Native Americans, a volcano crater, cactus, and canyons of various sizes, one really, really grand, and one really, really small, as we go to the national parks of Arizona. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen, and this is indeed episode 700 of the Amateur Traveler as we approach the 15th year anniversary. So let's celebrate. Yay! And now let's get back to work. Let's talk about Arizona. I'd like to welcome back to the show Gary Art from everything-everywhere.com, who's come to talk to us about Arizona National Parks. Gary, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for the, 15th or 16th time?
I don't know how many times. So, and it's not like it's been that long since I've talked to Gary. Gary and I also have been co-hosting This Week in Travel with a couple other friends for 10 years now. So we get to talk periodically. But you pitched me going to Arizona and seeing national parks. I would say, why should someone do that? But you already said national parks. So Arizona just has the Grand Canyon, right?
Well, that's the big one, I would say. You're looking at that's what it's best known for. But actually, Arizona has 22 different National Park Service sites, which places it third amongst all states as far as the number of sites, behind
I think
California and Alaska.
That makes sense.
Second, now that I think about it. But yeah, there's a lot.
Well, and I've been to a lot of these, but you actually came up with some that I'd never heard of. So that was one of the reasons that I was anxious to have you back on the show and talk about this. But let's talk about why should someone go to Arizona and see the national parks?
Well, for starters, you can go year round. And I think that's something that you can't do easily in a lot of parks. Last year, for example, I did a trip to Southern Oregon and Northern California. And even in June, a lot of the parks there were snowed in. And when I mean snowed in, I mean 20 feet of snow snowed in, right?
Right.
So this is in the summer, and there's still so much snow because it's at altitude. And you're not going to really see that in Arizona, especially in the south. So if you're looking for a trip in the winter or something, it's a great place to go. And there's a great deal of diversity. These aren't just natural sites, although it certainly has those. There's a great deal of history that goes back to the ancient people who lived in this area before Europeans showed up, as well as a westward expansion and a host of other things. So there really is a wide diversity. And you're also going to see some landscapes that you're really not going to see anywhere else. There are other deserts in the United States, but the Sonoran Desert that you're going to see here is really unique and has some things that you're just not going to find, say, in California or Nevada or even Utah.
The one exception I can think of to you're not going to run into weather here would be the north rim of the Grand Canyon, which closes in October, I want to say, because it had closed before we did a trip in October of last year. It hadn't snowed in yet, but all services were closed and the lodges closed and all facilities are closed at that point. And then it will snow in and they'll stop plowing the roads as soon as the snows happen.
Yeah, so I was last there in January of 2020. So I was primarily in the Tucson area, but then I made a trip up north around Flagstaff. And a lot of people don't realize that there's snow up in Flagstaff primarily because of the elevation more than anything. And so, yeah, there was definitely snow on the ground when I visited some of the sites. But I live in Minnesota, so this was like the Fisher Price my first winter. It was not a lot of snow. It wasn't that cold.
Right.
The roads were open. You could actually go and see stuff.
Well, and I remember being at the Grand Canyon in April when there was snow at the rim and it was 80 degrees at the bottom. So it depends a lot where you are.
Absolutely.
So what kind of itinerary do you recommend?
It really depends on where you're going to be. I think most people are probably going to be flying into Tucson or Phoenix.
Right.
And the third place might be Flagstaff, which is a much smaller town, but it's in the north. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of pockets of parks around those. And the first one I would bring up is a park. Well, it's a national monument, and it's extremely unique among all the sites in the United States. And that's Hohokam Pima National Monument. And it's unique because you cannot visit. And if you could visit, there is nothing to see.
Well, that is unique in an unusual way.
Yes. So I have, and it needs a little bit of explanation. So just south of Phoenix is the Hohokam Pima Reservation.
Okay.
And there was an archaeological dig there. I want to say it took place in the 70s, 60s and 70s, called Snake Town. And what they ended up doing was, once the excavation was over, they reburied it. So it got declared a national monument, and it's on the reservation. And they don't let you go and visit the site where Snake Town is. But if they did, there's literally nothing to see because it's buried. And for national park collectors, it poses a problem because, for whatever reason, it's still on the books.
Huh.
But there's no visitor center. There's nothing. But technically, I'm really getting technical here. If you look at the outline of what constitutes the national monument, there's an interstate that runs through it. So if you actually go, it's like part of the beltway beneath Phoenix. If you're on that road, you will technically drive through this area and you will see nothing. There's nothing there. So it's kind of an oddity. I don't know why it's still on the books or why it's there, but supposedly there was a cultural center for the tribe and you could go there and they had a display about Snake Town, but then they closed it and they're going to be reopening it again. And you could actually get a stamp there, and that would be the closest thing to a visit. But other than that, I mean, I think we could talk about, so there of the 22 sites, there are three national parks proper. The first is obviously the Grand Canyon. I don't know how much we even need to talk about that. I'm sure you've done shows on the Grand Canyon.
We have done a show on the Grand Canyon in the first year of Amateur Traveler. And then we did another show later on about rafting the Grand Canyon with George Wint, the now late founder of Oars Rafting. But that's been a little while ago. So it's worth a mention.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's familiar with it. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you can access it from the north or the south. Mm-hmm. It's a very common trip for people to make from Las Vegas.
Yeah, although people who go to the south rim from Las Vegas, that's a long drive.
Right. I mean, and it should be noted, the Grand Canyon's this enormous chunk taken out of the state of Arizona, and there are no bridges to get around it, right? So you have to drive around it or fly over it. Mm-hmm. The southern rim is lower elevation and by far the more popular of the two sides you can visit.
It gets 90% of the tourism. Am I right about that?
That would sound about right.
Mm-hmm.
If you go a further upriver, you get into the Glen Canyon recreation area.
Right.
And that's where that's like Horseshoe Bend is a famous site of that. I think most people may have seen the photo. Also a National Park Service site on the Colorado River, but not part of the canyon. And if you go downstream, there are also some Indian reservations, one of which famously built the Skywalk. It's that horseshoe-shaped surface. Right. Yeah, so it's one of the most popular parks in the United States. It should have been put on the list of the seven natural wonders of the world. Instead, the Underground River in the Philippines made it.
Not that we're bitter.
Well, no, the way they selected it was kind of ridiculous. But yeah, it's the one thing that if you're an American, or even if you're not American coming to visit the United States, I think you should visit. I mean, it's literally alongside maybe Yellowstone and Yosemite. Those are considered the three crown jewel national parks in the U.S. system.
Right.
And it really is an incredible experience.
And the one thing I would say, so I was back at the Grand Canyon this year. I had not been since my daughter was 4 or so, and she is 30. So it had been a little while, and still beautiful, love it. Have still never gone down into the canyon, and so that's a whole different trip when you hike down into the canyon and spend the night and hike back up in, or raft it, which takes a week and you need to plan well in advance. But I did get the chance this time. You mentioned Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. I did get a chance to do one of the float trips from the dam, Glen Canyon Dam, all the way down to the borders of the Grand Canyon National Park, where you actually raft around or boat around the Horseshoe Bend. And it was enjoyable. It's a float trip. It's not a whitewater trip. It's easy. Anybody can do it. But I would say it was enjoyable. I would recommend it.
Yeah, and the other park I should probably mention that is up in this northern Arizona area that you can also visit on a day trip from Las Vegas is Pipe Spring National Monument.
Okay.
My last trip to Las Vegas, I went there. It is a historical site that really deals with early Mormon missions.
Hmm.
This is one of the sites. It's very close to the border of Utah. Again, not that far from Las Vegas. I'd say it's maybe a two-hour drive. An interesting site, again, does not get a lot of visitors, unless you're probably interested in early settler history or Mormon history or something like that. Most people are probably not going to go, but interesting site and kind of off by itself. I know a lot of people, when they're in Vegas, the two big trips are to go to Zion or the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And this is another one. I don't think there's any organized trips that visit this place. It's something you pretty much have to do on your own in the car.
Well, you mentioned something about national park collectors, and you and I are both national park collectors, and that's the kind of person who is going to go to this site. I'm the kind of person who is going to go to this site, although I didn't know about Pipe Spring. But one of the ways that you discover sites like this, besides spending way too much time on the national park website or Gary's website, is by having a national park passport. And that's the kind of thing that drives you to these little less known sites. And some of them are wonders and really undeservedly unknown.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to be getting to some of them that I think are really fantastic. One of the things about what I do is, like, yeah, I go to these park sites and I go to World Heritage sites.
Right.
A lot of times I'll visit them simply because it's a point on a map.
Yep.
So I'm really discovering it when I'm there. And I'd say 90% of the time, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like, wow, this is really interesting. I'm surprised more people don't know about that. And 10% of the time, it's a total dud and I'm scratching my head as to why this exists. But
sure,
it is really interesting. And the one other I think we should add kind of in this northwest area of Arizona is Lake Mead, which is
sure
primarily thought of as a Nevada park because mm-hmm that's where most of it is. But it actually does go into Arizona as well.
Okay. And that is a national recreation area, if I remember
correct
correctly. Okay.
Yeah. So there's boating and fishing and mm-hmm things like that. So then there's three different sites very close to Flagstaff, very, very close to each other, probably within a 45-minute drive.
Mm-hmm.
And you could easily visit all three in one day, two of which are so close together that they're kind of treated as a single unit. And it's Sunset Crater Volcano National Monument
mm-hmm
and Wapakie National Monument. Sunset Crater is a volcano. And mm-hmm it's a relatively recent eruption, so you can still see the full cinder cone. And it's not a very big park, so you kind of just drive through it. And the road that goes through the park, if you just stay on that road for about 20 minutes more, then you get to Wapakie National Monument, mm-hmm which is a completely different park. That's actually one of the several Anastasi Pueblo monuments that you're going to see around the Southwest.
Or the ancient Pueblo people, as I understand we now call them, because there's controversy about the name, but basically the first settlers in this area.
Right. And there are several of the dwellings that you can go visit along the road that goes through the park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really easy to, and you probably should visit both of those two together. Like I said, it is one road that takes you to both of them. And I'm pretty sure that the management of both of those sites are linked together. They're so close together. So there's like a major highway, and then the entrance to one of the sites is on the south, and then you drive the loop road, and then it takes you up to the northern end of the highway, and boom, you're there.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's one I have not been to.
Then the third is Walnut Canyon National Monument. And this is one of these pleasant surprises. Walnut Canyon is a surprisingly very steep and deep canyon, not Grand Canyon type, mm-hmm but it's very steep. And here, too, you see cliff dwellings, almost impossibly so. So if you go to Mesa Verde in, say, Colorado, Those are really large dwellings that were all built in rather large, I don't want to say a cave, but sort of like these cutouts in the sides of cliffs where they could build these rather large dwellings. In Walnut Canyon, there's more smaller sites built on these extremely steep cliffs, so steep that you kind of wonder how in the world anybody got there to build anything, let alone how they built it. And there's a walk you can take that takes you along part of this cliff route where you can actually see some of the dwellings. And then you actually see a lot of the dwellings across the canyon. So if you have a zoom lens, it's probably something that you're going to want to have. Again, I was there in January, and it wasn't so much that it was cold, but you're in this canyon and there were parts of it that were extremely windy and then parts where you're sheltered from the wind. But really interesting. And again, it's not one of the more popular sites, and it really probably should be a bit more popular because it's really interesting.
In my recollection of the ones that I have been to, the Native American sites in Arizona, they're all of a smaller scale that I can recall.
Yeah, there's Mesa Verde is kind of the sexy one. Go to New Mexico, you're going to find some pretty major sites there in like Chaco Canyon.
Right, sure. Which is where the Mesa Verde people came from and went back to, as we understand it.
Yeah, and it actually, with part of my last trip to Arizona, I actually dipped into New Mexico very briefly and visited the Gila cliff dwellings. Mm-hmm. Although the actual core cliff dwelling site, I wasn't able to visit because of ice. The path was iced over, and they wouldn't let it. I mean, I did get to see some of the lesser ones, but yeah, it's one of these many sites that are kind of scattered throughout this whole Southwest area.
Well, and the one reason that I hesitated before I said that they all tend to be of smaller scales, I haven't been to Canyon du Chelly. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, I think.
And I think that is the larger of the ones in Arizona?
Yeah, that's closer up to the Four Corners area.
Yeah.
And of the three, Navajo National Monument and the Hubble Trading Post National Historic Site, I haven't visited those yet. I have another. I'm going to revisit the Four Corners area in the future because there's also some Utah sites in that Four Corners area, like Rainbow Bridge National Monument,
right?
Where it's actually kind of hard to get to. Mm-hmm. It's not like you park your car and then go see it. You have to take like a boat trip that takes several hours to get to the site. So it's going to be a bit more of an effort, but I'm going to do a Four Corners trip and visit some of those Four Corners sites on the Arizona side and the Utah side. I've actually been to all the Colorado ones. There's just a handful I'm missing.
Okay. Just as soon as they let you leave the house.
Yes. We're recording this in March of 2020 for everyone listening, and travel doesn't exist anymore. It's kind of gone.
Where to next?
Probably, I mentioned there were three national parks in Arizona that have a national park designation. Probably talk about the second one, which is Petrified Forest National Park. Mm-hmm. As the name implies, it is the home to a lot of petrified trees. And I should also add, it became famous because it was a stop on Route 66.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a classic inn that's located in the park. Mm-hmm. And you can also see parts of Route 66, the old Route 66 that are there. There's some abandoned jalopies, I think, that are on the side of it. So that tends to be in the northern part of a park. There's a interstate that pretty much bisects the park into two sections. Most of the actual petrified wood is in the southern part of the park.
Okay.
And it's in a section called the Rainbow Forest. So when I was there in July, they were doing road construction, and you literally could not drive from the northern part to the southern part. So I had to leave the park and kind of make a big trip to go do that. So if that's your priority, I would definitely start at the southern entrance.
Okay.
Because that way you'll be guaranteed to see that part and then work your way up. I'm assuming by the time most people hear this that the construction will be done. But the Rainbow Forest is kind of the core area where you're going to find the petrified trees that are on the ground. And then the rest of the park is really desert landscape with a lot of interesting features, very colorful stratigraphy that you can see in the rock and things like that. But the heart of the park, I think, is really in the south, and that's what most people are going to be interested in, and that's the petrified trees.
I'm going to have you repeat that. Very fine stratigraphy?
Yeah.
So the stratified
layers. The different layers in the rock, yeah.
I can tell your background in geology is stronger than mine, Gary.
Well, yeah, I kind of went to school on it.
I think you just gave away that you have a geology major there. Excellent. Yeah, that's a larger park than I expect. when I think of some of the other petrified forest parks in the West, this one, the fact that it has a backcountry, that there are things to do besides seeing the petrified forest, always catches me a little bit by surprise.
Yeah, to be honest, if they just wanted to preserve the petrified wood parts of the park, this would be a very small national monument, but there is more to it. And here's the other weird thing. So normally they're very picky about you cannot take things out of the park.
Sure.
Right? Do not pick up any rocks. Do not pick up any of this stuff. Outside of the park.
Holbrook?
Holbrook. Yeah, Arizona. There are tons of businesses that sell petrified wood, very large pieces of petrified wood. And so I assume that what you see in the park is the stuff that's on the surface. And that there's lots of it in the surrounding area and private property that people have dug up, and they actually sell that now. So you actually could take some petrified wood home.
Interesting. Just not from the park, please.
Yeah. Then we can go down to the south around Tucson. And this is where I spent a fair amount of time. And there's a selection of sites down there as well. Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument is right on the border with Mexico. As the name suggests, it features Oregon pipe cactus. There's a huge controversy about this park right now insofar as the government wants to put a wall with Mexico right through the park or on the border of the park, at least. And on the other side of the border into Mexico is a national park as well, which is UNESCO World Heritage Site. And I was going to go there from Tucson, although it turns out just because of that slant, that kind of diagonal slant in the bottom border of Arizona, it's actually closer by a little bit to Phoenix.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah. So I'm going to visit that as part of the trip to Phoenix and just the way the roads work out. So I'm going to probably end up going there on a Phoenix trip where I'll be visiting some more of those sites. So I have like one or two trips to Arizona to sort of complete everything. And in fact, I skipped some that I could easily get to from Phoenix in preference to harder to visit sites on my most recent trip. Mm-hmm. But around Tucson. So now we're in the southeastern part of Arizona,
right.
And we go to the third site with the national park designation, and that's Saguaro National Park. And there are two units to the park, an east unit and a west unit. The east unit is larger, but the west unit probably has a better selection of the cactus. And the Saguaro cactus is the tallest cactus in the world, and it's the quintessential iconic cactus. If you were to see an image of the Southwest that has like two bent arms sticking up on either side, that's a Saguaro cactus. And the density of them is really high in the western segment of the park. I mean, it's like being in a cactus forest almost.
Right. Oh, yeah.
I think it was in the 1960s. There was a freeze that occurred where the temperatures in Tucson dropped below freezing for like 2 days. And a lot of the cactus died. And there were people saying that by the 1990s, all of the Saguaro cactus were dead. That didn't happen. You can see a lot of damage on a lot of the cactus, which I think is just a natural process of insects and birds that may hollow it out, nest in it and things like that. So it's hard to find like a pristine cactus because there's things in the ecosystem that want to eat it. But I would definitely, if you ever visit Tucson, this is one of the things you definitely have to do. Beyond the cactus themselves, there isn't a ton in the park.
Mm-hmm. But it's not like it took you long to get there from Tucson. I mean, this is a park that is practically in the city.
Yeah, it's just on the outskirts of the city on either side.
Right.
So it's super easy to visit. It's not hard at all. And on either side, there's like a drive you can do that will take you through a loop. On the eastern side, there's a very defined drive. And on the western side, it's pretty easy to visit as well.
Well, and we've talked about this in an episode we did on Tucson, but as I recall, a cactus has to be like 100 years old before it gets an arm or something. So these are surprisingly old for how little they have grown. I mean, they obviously grow very slowly in this dry climate.
Yeah, and they grow really slow. And the national park is most definitely the highest concentration that I saw. I visited a bunch of other sites around Tucson, and you could see Saguaro cactus in other places, but it was kind of here and there.
Sure.
Whereas with park, it truly is dense. And there's only a few other parks that are really built around a single organism. I'm thinking like Redwood.
Joshua Tree, Redwood, yeah.
Yeah, but even in Joshua Tree, I think there's kind of other stuff there.
Yeah, a lot of the geology.
Named after it.
Yeah.
But this almost more than any other park, I think, is really built around the plants that are there. Because even in Redwood National Park, I think there's other neat stuff. It's a coastal area. Mm-hmm. But with this, it really is the cactus. If you drive south of Tucson on the interstate for about 45 minutes, you'll get the Tucumcari National Historic Park. And this is, I believe, the oldest Spanish mission in Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a compound. So you have the main mission church. Mm-hmm. They still have the orchard that was used by the monks that were there. I believe it was originally started as a Jesuit monastery, and then it was eventually taken over by the Franciscans when the Jesuits got kicked out by the Spanish.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, very interesting. There are other Spanish mission sites in the area, but I think this is by far probably the best preserved and the biggest. San Javier is right outside of Tucson, but it's not a national park. It's actually an ongoing mission. There's still a parish there. They still have services and things like that. Worth visiting. And you can actually visit it on the way because it's also on the southern part of Tucson. But Tucumcari is kind of in that tradition of the Spanish history. And that's also a really interesting history as well, because that area, I mean, this was part of Spain. At one point, I think a lot of people forget it. And this is also part of the country that was part of the Gadsden Purchase. So it was part of Mexico, like a legit part of Mexico for quite a while.
Well, and I was curious. I was looking up for how old these missions were, and I didn't get exactly how old this one was. But most of the missions in this chain of missions, and again, like the ones in California, you're probably building them about a day's drive apart. Days ride apart, horses, not cars. And they were started before the California missions, or at least they started in 1691, the oldest of these missions, probably on the other side of the border, I would guess, but dating back further than the California missions, which I know finished more like 1776, I think, is San Francisco. I'm doing this off of the top of my head, and these were established until about 1756.
I want to say that the Tucumcari mission was established, in the late 17th century, mm-hmm. and the buildings which are currently there date back to the mid-late 18th century.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a definite difference between when the current buildings were there and when the mission was established.
Got it.
Then if we go back to the border, we have Coronado National Memorial, and that really just sort of, it's a memorial. So it just is a commemoration of kind of the relationship that the United States and Mexico have. Hmm. It's a very small visitor center. There's not a whole lot to see. And it also talks about the Gadsden Purchase and why it was bought basically to make a railroad to get to California.
Right.
And that was it. You could easily drive down there and visit the whole thing in maybe easily an hour, easily. If you've ever been to a visitor center at a National Park Service site, they almost always have a film.
Right.
That might be in an actual projector, or it might just be on a large TV mm-hmm. screen. To give you an idea, the film at Coronado National Memorial was on an iPad. And they just gave you an iPad and sat you down, and that's what it was.
Got it.
So there's two more I want to talk about.
Well, and before you get to those two, just for those people who don't remember their early history of the explorers, who didn't have the American Heritage Explorers book or Discoverers or whatever that one was called that I had as a kid, we're talking about the first trip up into what is now the United States by the Spanish in the 1500s. So this is basically 1540 to 1542. They go all the way up into what is now Kansas, and that's Coronado. So it's worth commemorating, even if you don't get a motion picture experience.
Yeah, I mean, I should have added that's what the Coronado from Coronado comes from.
Right.
It's a Spanish explorer.
Yeah, Francisco Vasquez de Coronado.
Yeah, and they talk about his trip up, and they were looking for gold, of course.
Well, sure.
they didn't find any.
Right.
So now we're moving towards the eastern border next to New Mexico, and there are two sites. Chiricahua National Monument. This was far and away the biggest, most pleasant surprise.
Hmm.
This is a site that could get national park status and mm-hmm. probably should. It's not a huge site, but the closest thing I could explain it as, and this will probably resonate with you, is that it's very similar to Pinnacles National Park in California.
Sure.
But better.
Oh, okay.
There is this just field of pinnacles. And if you go to my website, you can see photos I have taken from the park. But yeah, it's just a really neat landscape. And given some of the national parks we have with a national park status, I think Chiricahua would clearly qualify compared to like Hot Springs National Park or something like that, which should not be a national park.
Well, and I should defend myself because I know you've just generated an email from Jeff Olfs, who's a patron and a regular listener and contributor to the show and former National Park Ranger. He is definitely writing me at this moment as we're talking, saying there's no hierarchy in the national park system of national parks being better than national monuments.
Except there is. I mean, officially, that's not true, but you don't have congressmen lobbying to get the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore became Indiana Dunes National Park.
Well, but Congress can form national parks and the president can form national monuments. Am I correct? Something like that.
Correct, but it's marketing.
It's true.
White Sands just became White Sands National Monument to White Sands National Park. Why? Because they want more visitors. So there absolutely is a hierarchy, even though officially, you know, according to the Park Service, there isn't, and they're all equal. We all know some parents love their children more than others. And if something has a national
to the
park,
National Park Service, there is no difference. But to the marketing of the congressman, there may be. Yeah.
If someone says, oh, I visited all 61 national parks, and there's 61 now, by the way. It used to be 59, and then it keeps changing. But if someone says, yeah, I'm visiting all the national parks, well, are they visiting all 419 National Park Service sites, or are they visiting just those 61? And most people will consider those 61 to be the national parks.
Yeah, I'm definitely not one of those people, but I know what you mean.
Right.
And there's over 400 now. That actually surprised me, too. I think when I got up my first national park passport, it was 360-ish.
Yeah, they make them every so often. The newest one is... Well, I don't think it's official yet, but it's about to become, and it's in Missouri along the Mississippi River. I want to say it's like St. Genevieve or something, but yeah, so there, it depends on the president and things like that.
Sure, yeah.
There's only been a couple, I think, made in this administration. But Chiricahua National Monument, this was Navajo country.
Okay, I would have guessed Chiricahua. Is the Chiricahua a branch of the Navajo?
Oh, man, I want to say it's a Navajo word. But it's definitely Navajo, and we get to that by the site that's very close to here, which is Fort Bowie National Historic Site. And this was a former U.S. Army base, the Cavalry, when they were doing things out west, and they fought their wars with the Navajo. A lot of it was done out of Fort Bowie. And if you're going to visit this area, and it's kind of in a remote part of southeastern Arizona, you definitely want to visit both of them. Chiricahua can be easily visited by car. There's a road that goes through the park and parking lots, and you get out and walk around. Fort Bowie, on the other hand, I didn't know this until I arrived. It's a 3-mile walk from the parking lot to Fort Bowie. So you cannot just drive up there. It's not a strenuous walk. It's not that bad. And the road to the parking lot where you get out is kind of a gravel road. There is a visitor center once you get there, but it takes time. You just need to be prepared for that. And I didn't realize that when I got there. I did the walk and everything and spent some time. And there's a few historical sites along the way. There's a small cemetery that you walk past where it has some of the victims of some of the Navajo raids of the settlers. And interestingly enough, several of them had the Congressional Medal of Honor. And this was back when the Congressional Medal of Honor, I think, was given out a little bit more liberally than it is today, I think. During the Civil War and during the Indian Wars, there were a lot more given out, certainly as a percentage of...
It was a much smaller army at the time.
Right. And today, I think if you earn it, it's a much bigger deal and it requires... They have a much higher standard. But that is one of the things you can see along the way. And then when you get there to Fort Bowie, it's basically ruins. You can see the outline of where the buildings were. Most of them were Pueblo construction. So you can see the outlines of the walls and you can see the field where they marched and things like that. But that's pretty much what you're going to be seeing. There's a lot of history in this site and in the location, but it's not like it's all the buildings are there because most of them have disappeared from the elements because it really is in a remote location.
Right.
It's not a place you're going to get to easy. You just need to be prepared about that walk before you make it.
And I did want to do one correction. Chiricahua National Monument. Yeah, the Native Americans who lived there were the Chiricahua, which is an Apache branch, not Navajo. The Navajo are nearby.
Oh,
but
you're right. It's Apache. Why? I don't know why the hell I was saying Navajo.
That's okay.
Absolutely right. Navajo are further north.
Right.
Yeah, like the Four Corners area. You're exactly right. It should be Apache. I'm sorry. So if you've gotten to this part of the podcast and you've already written your email, you cannot delete it.
Excellent. We have a few left.
Yeah, and I should also, just as an aside, the Apache, really good warriors. Really fantastic. And I think you really get a good sense of that when you read some of the history of what happened in the area. So the remaining ones, they're kind of the final ones. I've talked about Hohokam Pima, which is the site that both does not exist and you cannot visit. A lot of them are ancient native sites that are kind of around, I won't say around the Phoenix area, but they're certainly within.
Around Sedona, I would say.
Yeah, Montezuma's Castle National Monument and Tuzagut National Monument. I actually drove right past them coming back from Petrified Forest. They're not that far off of the interstate, so they're
very easy to visit.
A day trip that you can do. I just didn't do it because when the time I was driving back, it was very close to the closing time, so I wouldn't have been able to visit them. Tonto National Monument, Casa Grande Ruins National Monument.
Now, you have been to them before, though, as I recall.
No.
Okay, then I'm confusing you with me. So I have been to both of those. So they are relatively small Native American sites. Montezuma's Castle, though, is very well preserved, a very beautiful site. Tuzagut isn't quite as well preserved, but it's up on the top of a hill. So it's a beautiful area in terms of the view and such. But again, very easy to visit, both in the same day easily and Sedona at the same day. So they won't take you a lot of time and worth a stop.
Yeah, definitely. I visited here in, like I said, January 2020, and I could easily see myself coming back in the winter next year to visit these sites because I thought that, oh, well, winter in Arizona, there's going to be tons of people, especially in like the Tucson area. Their big event in the winter is the Rock and Mineral Show or the Gem Mineral Show. And I think that starts in late January, early February. The whole town will book up for that. So prices for hotels will go up. But other than that, I found prices all over Arizona for like a motel, if you're just on a road trip, to be really affordable, like $40 a night.
Now, Phoenix is going to be a lot busier in the winter, especially once spring training starts. And the price is going to be twice as much during spring training as they would be in the summer when it's going to be over 100 degrees.
But if you go, like it said, in January, which is before spring training starts, there are some really good deals to be had. I totally would go there again that time of year because I live in Minnesota, so upgrade in weather and affordable. And all these sites are accessible easily that time of year. And the weather wasn't that bad. Temperatures would get up into the, say, like the low 60s, mid 60s most days, with a high variation in temperature because it is in the desert. So, you know, get pretty warm in the middle of the day and then and drop down to maybe in the high 30s, low 40s in the evening.
Yeah, last time we went to visit friends in Phoenix, we actually didn't go in spring training, even though I love to be there at that time of year, but went a month early. And you're right, it's nice weather, great to be outside. I'd much rather would be in Phoenix in January than I would in July. So, and interesting, and we've of course talked about both Tucson and Northern Arizona and Phoenix and the Four Corners regions on other episodes of the podcast as well, and I'll link to those.
Yeah, and I should add, there's some great parks to visit that are not
I was going
parks.
To ask that. Yeah, because I was always surprised, for instance, that Meteor Crater, for instance, isn't in the national park system.
Yeah, and that's not too far from some of the sites around Flagstaff that I mentioned. Because I saw the road signs, and I had a limited amount of time, so I'm like, all right, I'm going to prioritize and visit the national park sites. But if I had, say, another day, I easily would have gone. And then also the Navajo parks. Up in that Four Corners region, the Slot Canyons, they've become extremely popular.
So we talked about them in the show in the first year of the show. And I went in 2006, I want to say, to visit Page, Arizona and Antelope Canyon. And I remember showing up at Lower Antelope Canyon and having a tour by myself first thing in the morning. And that is not what you will find today. We just did it again this fall. Although I thought they managed the crowds very well, but it's much, much more popular than it used to be. And it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I went to Antelope Canyon. I led a tour several years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was basically you have a group of people and you walk really fast towards one spot. And you all take a picture with no one in it. And then there's a group behind you and a group ahead of you, and you all kind of move forward so you can all get a picture where everyone's right around the corner so nobody can see it. You cannot take a bad picture in Antelope Canyon.
I still say, if you do, sell your camera and buy postcards, because it is such an amazing place. Yeah. Well, and the thing that I loved this time about visiting, and I was fully expecting to be disappointed, because I knew it had gotten much more popular. It's more expensive than it used to be. You need reservations, especially if you're booking in a more busy season, multiple days ahead. And so I was fully expecting it would be a lesser experience than it was when I was there, when it wasn't as popular. And that was not what I found. It is still stunningly beautiful. Everybody that I brought loved it. And the other thing that's different is everybody's got their iPhones, and your guide knows how to take good pictures now, which that really wasn't the case before. I think they've upped their game a lot. They made the canyon one, like Lower Antelope is one I went to, which is the one that used to be unpopular. Upper Antelope was the popular one that people went to. And they made it a one-way journey, so you're not kind of trying to get past people in these narrow areas. And I thought they managed it really very well. And it was thoroughly enjoyable. Now, I was in October, so I wasn't there in the heat of the summer, and I wasn't there in the most busy times, but still, gorgeous, gorgeous place.
And it's a place you want to visit in the middle of the day. Most places you want to photograph early in the day or late mm-hmm. in the day. Slot Canyon, you want to do kind of in the middle of the day, so you can get those beams of light coming down.
Well, see, I've always said Upper Antelope Canyon noon, Lower Antelope Canyon earlier in the day.
I think I've only been to Upper. So.
Oh, okay. I see. I actually prefer Lower. Lower is much longer than Upper. So it's a much larger
slot canyon. So
yeah,
that's kind of it. And we should also add, technically not in Arizona, but the Monument Valley, uh-huh. which is like
just
over
the border,
mile into Utah over the border. But that's also another Navajo park. And most people are going to be accessing it from Arizona.
Right.
Yeah, you can consider it there as well. That is, along with a saguaro cactus, the mesas of Monument Valley are quintessentially the Southwest, right?
Yeah.
John Ford shot a lot of his movies. In fact, this place are called John Ford Point, also a Navajo park. So they've taken the resources that they have in the land that they have, and they're using it for tourism and parks. So.
Right. Before we wrap up, any other parks that are not national parks that you want to give a nod to? State parks or?
I really can't think of any state parks. I wasn't really paying attention to it, although I'm sure there are. I know extensions, like there's a national monument that's an extension of the Grand Canyon, but it's not a National Park Service site. Hmm. I think it's under the Bureau of Land Management.
Okay.
But it is a national monument. That's the weird thing about national monuments. Most national monuments are part of the park system, but not all national monuments. Some are run by the Bureau of Land Management, some are run by the Forest Service, and I think a few even by the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay, because there is Vermilion Cliffs National Monument, which is managed by BLM, and it's in between the north rim of the Grand Canyon and Page, Arizona, that we talked about with Antelope Canyon. So right along the Colorado River, just north of it. Very beautiful site, but very basic. It's much more of an outdoor, off backcountry kind of thing. And there, for instance, there are places like the Wave and some well-known spots there that you need a backcountry permit to get to. And they really don't recommend that you go there if you don't have backcountry experience. But even just driving by the cliffs or rafting down the Colorado River by the cliffs of Vermilion Cliffs National Monument, it's a beautiful place.
I know it's Grand Canyon Parashant National Monument.
Oh, okay.
And it's usually called Parashant National Monument, mm-hmm. but it's not a Park Service site. Huh. And, you know, if I was Secretary of the Interior for like a week, I think my top priority would just be reorganizing a lot of this stuff so it makes more sense. And I would move the Forest Service out of the Department of Agriculture, which a lot of people do not realize that it's part of the Department of Agriculture, sure. not the Interior, and move it into the Department of Interior and try to create some sort of order with how all this federal land is divided and organized.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the reason it's in the Department of Agriculture is we use those trees as an agricultural renewable resource is the reason it ended up in there, as I understand it.
I think that was the original reason.
Or it's politics or something, you know.
But today, A lot of the national forests are, and they could still do logging and stuff like that on in those places. I mean, they have different classifications for the National Park Service, and the Bureau of Land Management is in the Department of the Interior. And so there's different land usage requirements for different types of federal land. So I don't think that's a problem.
Excellent. As we go to wrap this up, you are standing in the prettiest spot in an Arizona national park of any stripe. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
You're definitely on the rim of the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
I mean, there's, or I should say, you are probably overlooking Horseshoe Bend in Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. I think that particular site of the bend is pretty great, whereas there's just lots of sites along the Grand Canyon. I haven't been to Horseshoe Bend in several years.
But oh, my gosh, there, it has changed.
There were no guardrails. There was nothing. Most people didn't even know about it. It was just a gravel road, and then you had the park. So I'm kind of curious as to what it's like now.
It has changed dramatically. There is a parking lot where you pay for parking, a paved path up, large crowds. It's Instagram that has turned this into a very popular spot, but it is a beautiful spot. I would say early in the day instead of late in the day. I found that late in the day I was shooting into the sun, and so it would have been better if the sun had been behind me earlier in the day. But a beautiful spot. It's really kind of one picture. So whether it's worth the parking, you're in the middle of nowhere, you're out there, I would do it. But I wouldn't say that it's more than just the one picture.
I would also say Chiricahua National Monument.
Oh,
if you take the road all the way up, it's kind of a winding road that goes up a mountain. And then once you get to the very top, that's when you can kind of really see all of the stone spires. They're kind of like hoodoos. I don't know if they're officially called hoodoos, but it's kind of basically the same thing. That's really a fantastic view. And there's one particular view, and I have a picture of it on my website, where you look out into this opening into this greater valley in the distance, and you have all these rock pillars that are there. That's another great one, too.
Well, and as I will do every time that Gary comes on the show, I would recommend his website, not just for reading about things, but for his wonderful photography, for which he has won numerous awards. And one thing that makes you laugh and say only in Arizona National Parks besides the Buried National Park, because that's clearly the first answer to that question.
Probably petrified forests. I know there are other places in the world that have petrified wood, but you're just not going to see it so easily exposed like you're going to in Petrified Forest National Park. And in fact, I think it's on the tentative list for the United States to become a World Heritage Site.
Oh, really? Huh.
I don't know if or when that'll ever happen, but significant and unique enough that was placed on that list.
Excellent. Where our guest again has been Gary Arndt. And Gary, I'm assuming where I should send people in terms of your site is this wonderful page that you have that I've been looking at this entire time, which may be the only link in this episode, which is the National Parks in Arizona on everything-everywhere.com.
Yeah, I have pages set up for every state in the United States with a full map showing you where everything is. And photography of all the sites, if I've been there. And as I visit more sites, I keep updating the pages. And as they make more sites, I'm always very anal retentive about making sure that I have the latest list. So, yeah.
Well, and the only disadvantage I would say of going to Gary's site is I find when I go to Gary's site, I find that I don't know what I'm doing with my camera. So one of these days, maybe I'll take one of Gary's. He will do photography tours occasionally. So something you might think about. Gary, thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for national parks, especially for those in Arizona.
Thanks for having me.
In news of the community, let me first put out some thanks to two new patrons of the show on Patreon, Chris Kilworth, who is also started his own podcast. And unlike me, he said he would do that episode on climbing Everest. So we'll find out what his podcast is and get you that information. And then also thanks to Cynthia Talmadge. And Cynthia says, thanks so much for all you do, all the episodes you have released. Your show is the reason my fiance and I went to Uzbekistan, which was life-changing. I am so inspired each time I listen, and especially now that I'm quarantined in New York City, each episode offers a respite and a chance to daydream. Thank you for your generosity, sharing so much information over the years. Keep it up. Well, thanks to both of you. We will try and keep this up. I also heard from Justin, who commented on the episode we did on climbing Kilimanjaro. This brought back fond memories. Thanks for sharing. We agree, do the hike before the safari. We did the Limosho route from the west and summited the Western Breach, so a little bit different experience. We also did early September, which matched well with seeing the Great Migration. If interested, we kept a log with photos and videos. And I'll put a link to Justin's blog in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.
I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe.